Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Flory, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. We're here for the case of State of Minnesota versus Hammond. And let me just first indicate for the sake of our audio record that we are hosting this argument by online interactive platform. In fact, we're using Zoom government. No one's in the same room today. And so, if you will, counsel, please be aware that in the event there are any technical issues, we'll try to be mindful of them and we'll pause the recording or the proceedings if necessary to make sure that everyone can hear okay. But in the meantime, let's first make sure that everyone who is in this conference can see and hear all other participants. And we'll begin with my colleagues. Chief Judge Siegel, if you could speak so we can hear you and determine whether or not we can indeed hear you.
I am here.
Very good. Judge Flory?
You're coming in loud and clear.
As are you. Counsel?
I am here as well. Mr. Erickson's here.
Thank you.
Likewise, Your Honors, and I can hear you all well.
Wonderful. And we can see and hear you as well. So I'll just... in the past, we've had a few proceedings where counsel indicated their difficulty in seeing the clock. And just so you're aware, if you're not already familiar with how the platform works, there's an option for you in the top, probably in the top right-hand corner, for you to choose either speaker view or gallery view. And as long as you keep it in gallery view, you'll be able to see all of the screens open at once. And that will allow also a larger viewing of the clock. If you change over to speaker view, then the views that you have that don't include the current speaker will just be small icons or thumbnails. And that would mean that you would have a difficult time keeping an eye on the clock. We will of course maintain our usual restrictions. So counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for respondent with 15 also, and then an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those restrictions as you argue your case. And even though we can see you right now and we can see your names because of the platform we're using, we won't have that benefit in the audio recording. So please, as is our custom, we ask that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And with that, unless there's anything that needs to be discussed otherwise, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Andrew Hammond. We raised two issues in our brief. Because the sentencing issue is currently before the Supreme Court in State v. Robinette, I would like to focus my time on our first issue related to the warrantless dog sniff search of Mr. Hammond's vehicle. After stopping Mr. Hammond for speeding, the state trooper developed a suspicion that Mr. Hammond was under the influence of marijuana. His suspicion of marijuana use was based on Mr. Hammond's bloodshot eyes, his prior drug-related violations, wild onions in the vehicle, and although not testified to because Mr. Hammond claimed that he never smoked marijuana. After obtaining this information, the trooper only believed that Mr. Hammond was a user and did not suspect that Mr. Hammond was a drug trafficker. As a result of this information, the trooper conducted a field sobriety test.
Can I pause you for a minute there? Yep. Under the objective standard that we apply, does it matter that the trooper in this case may have suspected one type of crime versus another if we can assume that we read the record and we conclude that a reasonable officer in this office, in the trooper's shoes, might have concluded that your client was using onions to mask the smell of drugs he was transporting, even if he was not under the influence of drugs?
Well, I think that his initial suspicion was based on drug use alone.
I understand that. My question for you is, since we apply an objective standard, not a subjective standard, am I correct that we don't base a determination on the reasonableness of the officer's behavior and what this officer thought, but what a reasonable officer might think under those circumstances?
it is an objective test, and you can look at all the evidence supporting the conclusion of drug possession, absolutely. But after he, you know, the biggest piece of evidence supporting the officer's suspicion, or an objective piece of evidence, was the bloodshot eyes and this concept that he had been using. There wasn't any other evidence of actual drug possession other than the possibility that maybe he had been using. So absolutely, you can consider that there were these wild onions in the car. But again, you look to this officer's training and experience, and in 20 years, he had never seen onions being used to mask the smell of narcotics.
Why does that matter? If he's aware that objects in a car that could tend to mask the smell of narcotics, why would it matter that he hadn't personally seen onions being used for that purpose? What if he had pulled up in a car and there was incense burning in the car? He'd never seen that before, but wouldn't a reasonable person draw conclusions about at least possibilities?
Absolutely possibilities. But again, you also have to look at the fact that he never smelled the onions. So I think it'd be very different if there was incense burning in the car. And he said, in my 20-year experience, I had never seen incense, but of course he could smell it, which would mean that it was being used to mask something. And there was a scent that could be used to mask. In this case, there were just wild onions sitting on the dashboard. The officer testified that he didn't smell them, and that he had never seen them being used in that situation. So absolutely, it's an objective test, but we also look to what the objective facts are that the officer did observe. And the officer did not observe any sort of scent that would be masking any sort of drug use.
If I could interrupt again, did that complete your question, Judge Ross, before I interrupt?
Go right ahead. Okay. I think as long as Mr. Erickson fully answered, then I'm happy to yield the floor to more questions.
All right. So two-part question. Did the officer have the right to ask Mr. Heyman whether he had ever smoked marijuana? And then does dishonesty to the officer, I mean, does that help bolster? How does that help? I mean, it seems to me that dishonesty might be another factor in saying, hey, there's something criminal afoot here.
Right. To answer your first question, so I think it's important to look at how this all played out chronologically. So after Mr. Heyman was taken out of the vehicle, the officer at that point still suspected drug use and that he was under the influence. So the question that the officer actually asked was, when was the last time you smoked marijuana? And I think that was a very reasonable question to ask at that time. And that was not an unlawful question by any means. But again, that went to use. That went to the fact that he believed that he was under the influence and that he was impaired at that time.
Well, hold on just one second. I don't want to take you off track of Judge Siegel's question, but I do want to interject here on the point you just made. There are a couple of things that may be going on in a reasonable officer's mind. One is that your client at that time was under the influence for the purpose of impaired driving, but for the purpose of whether to expand the scope of the search or expand the scope of the stop to suspect other things, isn't it plausible that the officer may have also suspected recent use of drugs without necessarily not necessarily inconsistent with the possibility that your client was not at the time under the influence? In other words, it's plausible, isn't it, that an individual could use drugs, get bloodshot eyes, but yet not be under the influence?
That is plausible. And I think if we assume that he had reasonable suspicion to conduct the field sobriety test based on the bloodshot eyes, everything he observed, and then after he passes the test, it's our position that at that point, then it becomes a hunch, because his belief of being impaired and under the influence, he had just taken the test and had passed it. So yes, there's a possibility that you can smoke marijuana and not be under the influence and not be impaired to drive. But at that point, everything that had led up to it then resulted in it just being a hunch, and a hunch is not reasonable suspicion.
I'd like to follow up with more questions on this issue, but I had taken you off course from answering Judge Siegel's question, and so I want to make sure that you have a chance to fully answer her.
That would require me to remember what the second part of the question was.
That's what I was concerned about. So once he got the answer, I've never smoked marijuana, which the officer, based on the history he looked up, you know, was not true, presumably. So does that in and of it, I mean, it seems to me that, well, tell me what you think about whether that is a legitimate factor in an officer saying, oh, there may be criminal activity afoot here, you know, and thereby help provide the justification for the search.
Yeah, you know, I think generally being evasive isn't something that a court can rely on solely on that. I think the Supreme Court has said that in Wiegand and also in Burbach. But in this case, again, that answer, if it was evasive and deceiving, it was supporting his officer's belief that he had used marijuana and that he was under the influence and impaired. So then, subsequent to that, the officer then conducted the field sobriety test. So at that point, once he passed that test, the reasonable suspicion of drug use and impairment dissipated and it became a mere hunch.
That's so where I want to pause you.
Yep.
I think the first part of your that statement is certainly true, that reasonable suspicion that he was under the influence is evaporated as soon as you give field sobriety tests and it's clear that there's no indicia of impairment. On the other hand, the fact of bloodshot eyes, or the fact of the passing of the field sobriety test, is not inconsistent with recent drug use. And the bloodshot, watery eyes might suggest recent drug use, and recent drug use might suggest drugs in the vehicle. And evasive answers to the question about use of drugs, dishonest answers, might give the officer some reason to suspect that the individual wants to take the officer off course from his suspicions about what may be in the car. So that's, I may or may not be right in that reasoning, but it seems to me that at least right now, at least that's plausible. Can you address that train of reasoning in an officer's mind and explain why that would be unreasonable?
I believe after he passes that field sobriety test and there's not confirmation of impairment or drug use at that point, if he would have failed the test, there absolutely would have been confirmation and corroboration of drug use. And at that point, there likely would have been reasonable suspicion. Once he passes the test, that becomes a mere hunch. And I think logic, the logic that you just went through, supports a hunch. And absolutely, at that point, with the bloodshot eyes, the officer still believed that. But there was nothing else he could point to at that point after he passed the field sobriety test.
Well, remember, we're talking about just what's reasonable, not what's certain. And it's not a hunch in the sense of, gee, I wonder if this guy is an illegal alien. Perhaps he's a, perhaps he's an embezzler. Those may be hunches. Here, we're just talking about basic, reasonable possibilities. When I go back and read Terry versus Ohio, for example, it was just an officer observing a back and forth walking and conferring between individuals in front of a department store that led the officer to suspect that maybe they're up to something criminal and that maybe they're interested in robbing this place. The Supreme Court didn't describe that analysis as mere hunch simply because there are alternative conclusions, but that these are just reasonable. My question for you is it unreasonable for an officer to have the train of thought that I suggested to you?
I do believe so. And I think I understand what you're saying about Terry, but in Minnesota, we look at it a little differently. I think what's more relevant and more applicable to this case is the Supreme Court case.
Let me pause you there. Are you suggesting that Minnesota's standard for reasonable suspicion is stricter than Terry versus Ohio?
I believe that our case law, including State v. Burbach, is stricter than Terry v. Ohio. And for example, in State v. Burbach, the officer had a tip that the individual in the car had possessed drugs in the last couple of weeks. The defendant was evasive, the defendant was nervous, had erratic driving conduct. All of those would logically flow to your conclusion of possible drug possession or drug use. But the Supreme Court said that is just not enough in Minnesota.
Am I correct? That was not a watery eye case? And there weren't potentially masking scents as in S-C-E-N-T-S in the car?
Well, there weren't any scents in this car either. But no, in that case, they smelled alcohol in the car. The defendant was brought out, took a field sobriety test, passed this field sobriety test, brought back into the car. They had information specifically about that car and about that defendant, that that person had possessed drugs in the past. And at that point, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that's not enough. So,
well, in that the only thing the officer had to go on, the only thing was the past drug behavior. It seems like this case includes more.
I don't think there could be anything more than a tip from a reliable tip from somebody saying that the defendant had possessed drugs in the last couple of weeks, and the officer knew that. In the last couple of weeks.
I mean, we're talking about the present. In this case, the indicia, the concerns, would concern something much more present than the last couple of weeks. And if an individual has bloodshot eyes, that would not suggest drug possession or use in the last couple of weeks, but much more contemporaneous to the stop, I think.
If the defendant fails a field sobriety test, I would agree with you. And again, there wasn't anything else. They didn't smell any marijuana smoke or anything else from the car. So it was just based on this idea of bloodshot eyes. The officer also testified that bloodshot eyes can be, you know, a result of not sleeping or allergies. Mr. Hammond told the officer when he was asking to do the field sobriety test, hey, I've been driving from Louisiana. I think that's a very reasonable explanation for why you may have bloodshot eyes. But again,
let me ask one other question on this line. What other than potentially wanting to take the officer off a train of suspicion would justify or would support the driver's decision to lie to the police officer about his previous marijuana convictions?
Well, one, he never lied about marijuana, not having marijuana convictions. One, we don't know if he had marijuana convictions. They were driving violations. The question was, have you ever, or when was the last time you used marijuana? And he said, never. A couple ways you can look at that. One, generally.
Wait a minute. I thought the driving violations were for drug related incidents.
They were, but we don't know if they were convictions or anything behind them. The officer didn't testify as to what they were. They were just charges. We don't know, but I don't think that that's necessarily relevant to your specific question. The reason, there are multiple reasons why he might answer that way. One is that he just doesn't want to tell an officer that he's used marijuana in the past. I think that's a reasonable response. It might not be the right one that we want citizens to respond to officers that way, but he doesn't want to be hassled by an officer. He doesn't want to tell him about his past. Not necessarily connecting anything to what was actually in the vehicle. I see my time is up.
Your time is up. However, I'm not just reading minds. I saw that Judge Flory's mute button went from mute to unmute, and I'm suspecting he might have a question he wants to ask you, and I want to make sure that he has a full opportunity to ask questions since I kept you on a train that may be dissimilar to the one that he wants you to be on.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Ross. And I did have a question in that your analysis, Mr. Erickson, seems to ignore the clear body of law that police officers are allowed to make come to conclusions based on their training and experience that might well escape an untrained layperson. And it seems to, the analysis then seems to ignore the whole factor of the masking agents. And we did get into that, but don't we give deference to the training and experience of police officers in their determination as to whether there's a reasonable suspicion for, in this case, a dog sniff?
We absolutely give deference, but we have to determine whether that the conclusions are reasonable. And again, the idea of this masking agent, his subjective experience resulted in him believing that Mr. Hammond was under the influence and impaired to drive. Subsequent to that, he passed the field sobriety test. So while absolutely his training and experience comes into play, and we defer to that, it is not an absolute. We agree with everything the officer says, and that therefore we affirm. We still have to determine whether it's reasonable. And in his training and experience, he had never seen onion being used that way. He did not smell the onion as a masking agent. And subsequent to that, Mr. Hammond passed the field sobriety test. And there
Why would he need to smell the onion as a masking agent? I mean, what if he saw in the car indications that an incense, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's stick. Not a pipe, an incense stick had been recently burned, even if he didn't smell it at the time. And he knew that I'm trying to think of what other reason an individual would have onions in the car. Wouldn't the fact that the onions are kind of dried out suggest that these onions had been there for some time, not being eaten, of course, but what other purpose would you have for onions being in a car other than to consume or to mask a scent?
A couple of responses, if I may. I know my time's out here, but
you're sure I've taken it's my fault. I've taken you over.
No problem. First is the officer testified that what he looks at or tries to figure out is whether there's something that smells in the car. So he actually testified to that. He said if there's an air freshener, he tries to figure out if it's a newer one or if it's been there for a while. So if it's been there for a while, it's less likely it's used as a masking agent. So it's the officer's own testimony regarding whether it smells a certain way. And that's how he can conclude whether it's a masking agent. The second part of your question, if there was a previously lit incense stick inside the vehicle, I believe that some people burn incense not because they're smoking marijuana, but because they like the smell of incense. So I don't think it would result in automatic reasonable suspicion, but it absolutely supports an officer's suspicion. But I don't think that's the be all end all by any means. Your third part of your question regarding the onion, Mr. Hammond had just been driving back from Louisiana. He's a forager. And I think it's reasonable that people pick flowers, they pick things on their way when they're camping or whatnot and put them in their car. So I don't think it's necessarily you connect a wild onion to drug use. I think that is a stretch and not a reasonable conclusion when it's not something that the officer had ever experienced before.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson.
You bet.
Rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Madam Chief Judge, may it please the court. My name is Zuri Balmakoon. I'm appearing on behalf of respondents in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Now, appellants are requesting that the court find error where none exists and apply precedent with limited scope broadly and incorrectly. And for the reasons stated by opposing counsel in this case, I will also be limiting the majority of my arguments specifically to the first issue, which is the issue of reasonable articulable suspicion in this case. Respondents in this case are requesting that the court affirm the district court's findings in order for three reasons. First, the district court did not commit error in its findings, and Trooper Rauenhorst articulated a basis for establishing reasonable articulable suspicion to conduct a dog sniff of appellant's vehicle. Second, appellant is not entitled to a reduction in his sentencing, as the commission had articulated an intent to have the amendments imposed after August 1st, 2019. And third, appellant has not articulated pro se issues with merit, and thus the district court's findings and order should be affirmed. First, Trooper Rauenhorst clearly articulated reasonable suspicion to conduct a dog sniff of appellant's vehicle in this case. Specifically, Trooper Rauenhorst had testified to a number of factors that allowed him to develop this suspicion. First, he testified to appellant's bloodshot and watery eyes, and we see in State v. Burback that can be considered one of many factors that can establish reasonable articulable suspicion. Second, Trooper Rauenhorst testified that appellant appeared to be nervous. He was not making eye contact and had also failed to turn off his right turn signal. And according to State v. Saivong, again, that can also be considered a factor.
How does a turn signal, what bearing does a turn signal have on the presence of drugs in the car?
Your Honor, it's not the turn signal that indicates the possession of drugs in the car. It's according to Trooper Rauenhorst's testimony, it's the fact that appellant had forgotten to turn off his turn signal that indicated that he may be particularly nervous. Of course, this wasn't the only factor that Trooper Rauenhorst considered in assessing whether appellant was showing a degree of nervousness that was higher than a normal traffic stop. For example, Trooper Weinhorst also testified that appellant would not make eye contact with him during the stop. The third factor that Trooper Weinhorst considered was the twofold. It was prior convictions for fifth degree drug possession, as well as prior controlled substance related issues that led to revocation of appellant's license. And Trooper Weinhorst did testify to these two specific things. Now, opposing counsel is correct in saying that Trooper Weinhorst did not say appellant had prior fifth degree controlled substance charges and then state a statute. He did not articulate it that clearly, but in a review of the transcript, Trooper Weinhorst distinguishes between his assessment of the fifth degree drug convictions, which he weighed, as well as the controlled substance convictions that led to the revocation of his license. And that can be found specifically on page 11 of the June 7th, 2018 transcript. A fourth factor, Your Honors, that the trooper had considered was appellant's deceit in answering his question. Now, opposing counsel had mentioned that Trooper Weinhorst did not ask whether appellant had smoked marijuana. He did ask this question, and that can specifically be found on, page 17 of the June 7th, 2018 transcript. And of course, this raised Trooper Weinhorst's suspicion because Trooper Weinhorst knew of the prior fifth degree controlled substance convictions and the prior controlled substance leading to revocations. And then finally, the masking agent was one of the factors that Trooper Weinhorst considered in establishing reasonable articulable suspicion for conducting the dog sniff. And in this case, Trooper Weinhorst had articulated that he had seen masking agents used in the past. He had never seen onions used, but he's heard of onions being used, and he'd even seen garlic being used. And this strange arrangement of onions on the driver's side dashboard raised Trooper Weinhorst's suspicion that appellant may have been using or in possession of narcotics. And Trooper Weinhorst does testify specifically. He was first suspicious that he might have been intoxicated. Then, having conducted the field sobriety test, he realized that he wasn't intoxicated, but the suspicion still existed because of the bloodshot and watery eyes. And then he also was suspicious of possession because of the factors that I had just listed. And that can be found on page 16 of the June 7th transcript. Finally, Your Honors, as to the first point, the district court—
I'm sorry, I was muted. What does the bloodshot, what does Mr. Hammond's bloodshot and watery eyes indicate?
According to the testimony provided by Trooper Weinhorst on the June 7th hearing, Your Honor, Trooper Weinhorst stated that the bloodshot and watery eyes can be an indication of marijuana use. As indicated by Your Honor earlier, simply because appellant wasn't under the influence of marijuana or alcohol, which was also what Trooper Weinhorst was testing for, does not mean that appellant had not used marijuana. And his suspicion was increased even further as to use when he asked the question if appellant had ever smoked marijuana, and appellant responded no. Now, the district court does not need to rely on Trooper Weinhorst's subjective interpretation of these factors, and an objective analysis of these factors taken under the totality of the circumstances leads to the reasonable conclusion that Trooper Weinhorst had reasonable articulable suspicion to complete a dog sniff of appellant's vehicle. Second, Your Honors, appellant is not entitled to a reduction of his criminal history score. And because this issue is under review with the Minnesota Supreme Court, I will be very brief in my recitation as to why. First, appellant relies incorrectly on the Kirby precedent to argue that the commission cannot abrogate the amelioration doctrine. And I think the Kirby precedent specifically states that they are not taking a position as to whether or not the commission can abrogate the amelioration doctrine. Second, existing precedent as to whether or not the commission can abrogate the amelioration doctrine does not answer the question of whether the commission can abrogate through an amendment to the actual calculation of criminal history score, specifically located in 2B2. Finally, Your Honors, as to my third point, appellant's pro se brief does not raise issues that have merit.
I have you appellant stick raises- with your second issue. What is your interpretation of the word otherwise in Minnesota statute 24409 subdivision 11? And I'm specifically referring to the and shall be effective August 1 of that year unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. What is otherwise referring to? Is it referring to the effective date? Is it referring to the substance of the amendments that were submitted to the legislature? Both? Neither? What does it refer to? How broad is the term or narrow?
Your Honor, respondents are interpreting the term or the word otherwise in the statute to be referencing the modifications themselves and not only the date that the modifications become effective. As listed within our brief, Your Honor, we take the position that limiting the modifications, simply limiting the legislature's power only to the date that a modification becomes effective is limiting a legislature's power in a way that was not intended by the statute or legislature.
Is there anything in the grammar or the syntax that supports that argument or that bears on that argument either way?
I believe, Your Honor, based on how the statute is drafted, that the language is not, as I stated, meant to limit the legislature's power. And I think that's supported by the following sentence: all other modifications shall take effect according to the procedural rules of the commission. But generally, Your Honor, that is more so based on the history of how the commission's modifications have been applied to the Minnesota sentencing guidelines and the legislature's lack of action. We have seen the legislature take action when they disagree with the commission's modifications, and they have not done so in the circumstances before us today.
Counsel, isn't there a difference between the changes made to the calculation of the criminal history point in terms of whether you can count the point where the person's been discharged from probation and the step taken here by the, it seems to me the commission's statement as to effective date is a policy statement. That's not a change in the calculation of the criminal history score. Those seem to me to be separate concepts. And while Kirby didn't squarely address it, they had an opportunity to when they came out and said very clearly, we have never ruled and declined to rule today that the amelioration doctrine may be abrogated by commission statements not ratified by the legislature. That would seem to go directly to the issue of the policy statement as to effective date.
So as to Kirby having taken a position on whether the commission can impose policy on an effective date, I don't believe that, or at least respondents haven't interpreted the Kirby language to state that the commission can or cannot. The Kirby language, as we interpret it, states that they are not taking a position as to whether the commission can reach a decision.
Well, it's because ordinarily, I think the Supreme Court says exactly what you just said when it wants to do what you just said, which is we take no position. What the Supreme Court said is we haven't in the past done this and we're not doing it now. Doesn't that indicate a substantive direction the Supreme Court is leaning towards or is implicitly adopting?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that is not the position that respondents are taking or respondents' interpretation of that language. That's not the way that respondents are interpreting the Supreme Court's decision or specifically that sentence in this case. Judge Flory had asked earlier whether there is a difference between the policy of the effective date and then the amendment to the calculation of the criminal history score. And I believe it is when we're reviewing the policy itself, specifically under 3G1, I believe we're reviewing an analysis of why they're imposing a specific modification. But if you're looking at the language that they used to direct how criminal history score should be calculated, that was not a policy language. That's an instruction on how this modification needs to be applied. As to my third and final point, Your Honors, appellant had raised three issues that did not have merit in this case. The court's decision-making process here was reasonable. It was supported by the evidence in the record. And trial counsel presented appellant in this case with reasonable representation and no prejudice was found as to appellant. For those reasons, Your Honor, because Trooper Rowan Horse had reasonable articulable suspicion, may I complete my conclusion, Your Honors? Because Trooper Rowan Horse had reasonable articulable suspicion, because the amendment to the 2019 Minnesota sentencing guidelines were not supposed to be effective until after August 1st of 2019, and because appellant's pro se arguments lack merit, the respondents are requesting that the court affirm the district court's arguments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yeah, just briefly, as I've been going through the chronology of what took place after the stop and the fact that all the suspicion may have existed that Mr. Hammond had used marijuana, if this court affirms and determines that this suspicion still existed, reasonable suspicion still existed after he passed the field sobriety test, that'd be the first time that a Minnesota court has reached that conclusion, that there's still a reasonable suspicion of drug use subsequent to a successful passing of a field sobriety test.
Please explain why it would be unreasonable. You seem to be taking the position that it is unreasonable to believe that a person recently consumed drugs, but not to the state of intoxication.
In this case, because the officer didn't observe any sort of marijuana smoke, did not observe any sort of paraphernalia in the car. The only thing that he's basing his conclusions on are his bloodshot eyes, which can be reasonably explained from being tired or allergies or other people have bloodshot eyes all the time. And again, that would give the officer suspicion to conduct a field sobriety test, but he passed it. There's nothing in addition to that that supports the conclusion that he may have used marijuana, but just not to the point of impairment.
Why not? This is where I'm lost in your argument. If there was enough for the officer, as you've just acknowledged, if there was enough information for the officer to have suspected impairment, meaning that your client consumed drugs recently and consumed them to the extent of his being impaired by them, what is it about his passing the field sobriety test that would do anything to diminish the suspicion that drugs were used recently? Just not to the extent to which the officer had originally suspected.
because there's nothing about the field sobriety test that confirmed that conclusion.
Right.
It went the other way.
The field sobriety test eliminated the suspicion that he had consumed drugs to the extent of his impairment. But what is it about passing the field sobriety test that would render unreasonable the officer's suspicion that your client had recently used drugs, relying upon all of the indicia, all of the circumstances that you said a minute ago would support the officer's suspicion of drug use to the point of impairment?
Because at that point, it solely became a hunch. There was nothing above the idea that he had these bloodshot eyes. How do officers, in ordinary course of doing their jobs, confirm that there had been drug use? Is by doing these field sobriety tests. There are ways of determining how to confirm that suspicion. And that suspicion was not confirmed.
I guess I'm just at a loss here. Are you suggesting that it's implausible for an individual to have consumed drugs recently and yet not been impaired by them to the point of failing field sobriety tests?
I think it's possible that you can consume drugs and not fail the field sobriety test. However, if that's what the officer is going to rely on, there has to be something more, like the smell of marijuana, like seeing something in the car that indicates marijuana use, that he can confirm marijuana use. There isn't anything like that. There isn't anything but a hunch that these onions were used as a masking agent. There isn't anything more than a hunch that his bloodshot eyes were because he used marijuana. There isn't anything more than a hunch that the fact that he said that he never used marijuana was because he had just used marijuana or that he had it in the vehicle. Those are all hunches. There's nothing. Those are all innocent. It's all innocent conduct that then results in this inference that's merely a hunch without confirmation through a field sobriety test.
You didn't mention it, and the district court did not include it in its analysis, but it struck me as strange that an individual pulled out when asked to present identification and the officer wanted to see the billfold to see if it was true that he had no identification, that he's carrying around a billfold that's entirely empty. The district court didn't include it in its analysis, but it strikes me that it's not implausible for a reasonable officer to suppose that an individual is intending to appear or to hide his identity in case he's stopped, that he wants to avoid the opportunity of the officer finding out who he was. It seems strange. Maybe it's not to you.
A couple of answers, and I do not believe it's strange because he provided him with written identification of who he was. He had he had lost his license, and he had documentation from the DMV saying that he was Andrew Hammond. His address, everything he handed to the officer. The officer ran the check. There was nothing about that was suspicious in any way. The officer testified to it, that this wasn't suspicious. People lose their licenses all the time. That has nothing to do with, if he would have said, I don't have any identification. I also have no papers on me. I'm not going to tell you my name. I don't want to be identified. That'd be one thing. But the first thing he did was he handed him all of his information. He had his license information. He had insurance for the car. It was all under his name. And it all checked just fine on all the tests or the databases that the officer ran it through. So I don't think that's an independent reason to suspect drug use by any means because he didn't have his driver's license.
Fair enough. And just to be clear, the district court also did not rely upon that.
No, nor did the officer, or did the officer testify that an objective person would think that that was suspicious of drug use.
Fair enough. Thank you to counsel for your written argument and for your oral arguments today. And we appreciate you accommodating our circumstances by appearing by Zoom as opposed to in person. The matter is submitted and we have taken it under advisement. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.